Moin moin liebe Leute, hier spricht Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und wie eine echte Feministin kann ich natürlich nicht kochen. Naja, nicht ganz. Ich mag kochen, aber das Ganze drumherum strengt mich an. Was koche ich heute und wieder neue Rezepte ausdenken und dann noch in den Supermarkt. Das Gute bei HelloFresh ist, dass du da jede Woche aus über 40 super Rezepten dir etwas aussuchen kannst und du kriegst alles so geliefert, wie du es brauchst. Und mit meinem Code FRESH24 könnt ihr in Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro sparen. Der Code ist für neue und ehemalige Kundinnen gültig. Testet es doch mal mit meinem Code FRESH24. Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's going on? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it again. And if you're new here, welcome. Nice to have you. Everything all right with you? I'm a little shattered in certain ways, but in other ways, completely solid. That's the nature of it, I guess. That's the way life works. I've been doing a lot of thinking and feeling and engaging. After that conversation with Neil and after some of the stuff I've been talking about on stage, it's a very strange thing to be a grown person in the world, but sort of crippled in many ways that other people don't seem to be. And it's always been like this for me, mostly emotionally. And I know I'm getting heavy right out of the gate here. You know, at certain points in my life, I've done material about everything that I've gone through. Is that for entertainment? I don't know. I don't know what it is, but it was the way and is the way that I make sense of the world and try to become a whole person is through this goddamn talking, through this fucking comedy, which is a little different. There's certain things that I don't talk about in my life because I've learned to keep certain things private just to, protect others, to protect myself, and to have a fucking life. And then there's some things I only do on stage and don't talk about here because I want the live exchange. I want to feel the sort of tension and release and also the impact that I feel when there's sort of a one-mindedness in an audience experience. And I don't even know why I'm being so serious right now. Hold on. Let me try to shift gears a little bit. I'm talking to Tiffany Haddish today. I don't know her well. I've met her a few times. I met her years ago before she got really famous. And she was like, I'm going to do your podcast someday. And this is the day. And that was like, oh, my God. It's got to be so many years ago. I recently did a panel with her at a Jewish event. Her career, as you know, exploded in 2017 with her breakthrough performance in Girls Trip. And since then, she's never stopped working. She works a lot. She's here to plug a book, her second autobiography. This one's called I Curse You With Joy. Tonight, I'm in Montclair, New Jersey at the Wellmont Center. Tomorrow, Friday, I'm in Glenside, Pennsylvania, near Philly, at the Keswick Theater. And then Washington, D.C. this Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. I'll be in Munhall, Pennsylvania, outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall, Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at the Playhouse Square, and Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all of my dates and links to tickets. We will have information probably early next week about the reschedules for a few of the dates that I'm not going to be able to do because I'm shooting. And outside of that, yeah, I've just been thinking about that conversation I had with Neil. I've been thinking about some of the stuff I'm doing on stage now. I've been thinking about, you know, trauma. And you know, I don't want to dismiss that. And I don't know how anybody received some parts of my conversation with Neil. But trauma, I've gone through a lot of, not self-help, but a lot of different ways to try to understand myself, my behaviors, you know, my whatever the hole inside of me is. And I've chosen not to believe it's a God-sized hole, but just a sort of gaping hole of insecurity that kind of through most of my life keeps me somewhat wide open. And but also as I got older, I learned how to hide that, to hide the wide openness to the best of my ability. I don't know. It seems that many of you, my audience, seems to see right through that shit. But I just been thinking about it because, you know, I spent time with my dad. And as your parents get older, you know, your feelings about them becomes different. You know, I mean, I think in the natural course of things, many people, I think, feel it's their responsibility to take care of their parents and to accept them for who they are now. And I think I do that. But where it's coming from is a very conscious sense of responsibility. It's not coming from an emotional need, you know, because as my dad kind of, kind of fades away mentally, a lot of the stuff that I loved about the guy or that I thought was amazing about him as I was growing up is still sort of there. But then you start thinking about all the other stuff. And what impact did that have? I think there's sort of an act of forgetting if you don't focus on your resentment or your anger, that as they forget, if you're lucky, you forget, because there's no one's going to pay that bill, and no one's going to change whatever was taken away from you when you were a kid. You know, that is gone. That opportunity is gone, and through whatever you need to do to kind of fix that inside yourself or parent yourself or do whatever or grow that hurt little fucker up, that's sort of on you. And as my mom gets older and she breaks down, this is a very vain, self-centered, hypersexualized person. And, you know, and she's having a very rough time at aging, and it was destined to happen. And I guess as I look at both of them, I wonder if that's what I'm going to be experiencing or how am I going to handle it? But I'm hyper aware of it. I don't experience, I guess I have a certain amount of fear, but what I started to realize, I got obsessed with the word triggered recently, you know, because there's a lot in the press about, you know, what's triggering, you know, what does that do, what we should or shouldn't say in order not to trigger people or, you know, trigger ourselves. But I look up the word and it kind of sent me on this kind of mental rabbit hole in myself. You know, there's a couple of definitions, right? There's the noun is a trigger, but the verb is to cause an event or a situation to happen or exist, like being born. I mean, it depends how you look at things. Or cause to function is another one. Of an event or situation cause someone to do something. Or there's this one, especially of something read, seen, or heard, distress someone, typically as a result of arousing feelings of or memories associated with a particular traumatic experience. And I realized that, like, my whole life, you know, was a reaction to being sort of triggered by, you know, how I grew up. That it was, you know, I don't know what your life was like, but I had to somehow figure out how to not, you know, be wide open all the time from a very, very early age, because my parents were, you know, they had no emotional boundaries or capacity for nurturing or selflessness or, you know, and there was, you know, that causes trauma because you're kind of left on your own. There's a lot of things that cause trauma. I was sexualized as a young person. I was, you know, kind of diminished by my parents' needs and insecurities and chaotic vulnerability. I was not given any sort of supportive or safe space to develop a sense of self, but I was given plenty of space to try to build one on my own without any guidance whatsoever, really, outside of their example, which wasn't great in terms of principles and consistencies. And that just makes you go out into the world with no real way to emotionally protect yourself or feel safe anywhere. So eventually you kind of figure out how to kind of, you know, be on guard, how to get laughs, how to sort of, insert yourself into situations or be charming if you're capable of it. But usually it's just you feel like and you act like a kind of, slightly broken-ish person. And I know people don't like that word broken, but, you know, You are a little bit. You can't hide the mark inside. That's what Burroughs says. So then you kind of move into the world. You choose new parents, role models, inspirations. I mean, most of mine were troubled, charismatic people, but they all had something that, as I look at it now, you know, as a guy that's like kind of, you know, kind of trying to reframe some of my past experiences in the sort of under the umbrella of trauma, which I think is real, and it's as good a way as any to try to, you know, figure out a portal through which to understand yourself. And, you know, so a lot of these people seemed that I could sense were troubled as well, but figured out a way through. You figure out a way through, and you press on. Like, I never really saw myself until recently, but not in in a deep sense. I can see where I've been a victim. I can see where I've been emotionally abusive or victimized others in terms of my emotional interactions. And all this stuff is now, like, I'm 60, and it used to be like, well, maybe there's no way I can, you know, I can work through this stuff. Maybe, you know, I am what I am. Fuck it. And I think that's what a lot of us do. But then all you're doing is what you're moving through the world with, what your emotional template is just some sort of elaborate shield. And I've been on the edge of this for a while. But you know, when you come from a life, and I'm only speaking to people that I can speak to here, where you were sort of denied the ability or not given any self-esteem or any way to get self-esteem. Your life is just a slow kind of car wreck in a lot of ways, you know, self-destruction. You know, I've experienced all this stuff, compulsion in all areas, addiction, anger, self-centeredness, an inability to selflessly give or receive love, profound shame that, it, you know, constantly destabilizes my sort of security or sense of self I might have, inability to compartmentalize anything. I have a constant distrust of almost everyone, yet conversely, I'm a total sort of emotional mark for any sort of hustler or predator or charismatic person. That's what I had to build from. And so as I've grown aware over time, you know, you have to, it's cognitive fucking approach, man. All right, I know this thing does this, and whatever this feeling is, this is what happens. So, like, you know, how do I hold strong? How do I make a boundary? It's fucking nuts. It's fucking nuts, and it's exhausting. But the truth is, there's some other thing that kind of kept me going and kept me plugging through, and I think a lot of this has to do with you know, that email I got from that guy who said that, you know, everything we do, relationships we get in, is somehow trying to recreate where we come from. Yeah. And he said that, you know, comedy is probably that. And I realized, and I used to say it a lot when I was growing up, that, you know, you got to put yourself in dangerous situations or frightening situations to see if you get through them. And, you know, kind of figure out how to hold steady. You know, that was the way that I decided to try to get some sort of authentic sense of self. And, you know, looking back on a lot of my comedy, you know, a lot of it is, it's not therapy, but it's me trying to understand life from my point of view. And that was all I set out to do. It is creatively and as funny as possible. But something different is happening because, you know, after my last special, you know, being able to talk about the traumatic experience of my partner dying and figure out how to mine that or process it in a comedic way. It sort of sent me on this path to figure out how to do that with other stuff in my personal life and heart. And it's pretty intense, but it's still what I'm doing. And I'm exhausted. Are you the kind of person who's always worrying about things back home whenever you travel? Did you lock the doors? Did you leave a window open or leave the oven on? I'm that kind of person when I travel down the street, let alone when I travel around the country. But one of the ways you can ease your worry is by having award-winning home security. And we've been recommending SimpliSafe for 8 years as the easiest way to get peace of mind when you're away from home. When you have home security, you want to know all the bases are taken care of. That's why we have SimpliSafe. That's why we have SimpliSafe monitoring, both inside and out, and we have sensors that will detect break-ins, shattered glass, even movement. And I don't have to worry about getting a false alarm because of my cats. It's whole home protection. It costs less than a dollar a day. That's a bargain for 24/7 professional monitoring. Plus, you don't have to sign any contracts, and there's a 60-day money-back guarantee if you're not satisfied. SimpliSafe already provides real peace of mind to us here at WTF and to many WTF listeners as well. I want you to have it too. Right now, get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system with Fast Protect monitoring at simplisafe.com/WTF. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. Yes. So Tiffany Haddish is here. Her new book, I Curse You With Joy, is out next week, May 7th. You can pre-order it now. And this got going. We got going. This is me and Tiffany Haddish.
Microphone checker.
Oh, my God. It's finally happening.
Finally, after all these years.
Do you remember when that was?
Oh,
when
my God.
When we were on the back porch of the Comedy Store, you're like, you don't know me.
Yeah, but you're going to know.
But yeah, I'm going to do your podcast one day.
Man, that was like 20.
Come on, no way.
16.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that might be right.
Yeah, 2016, maybe 2014.
Was that like before everything?
No. I mean, I had already been on the Carmichael show.
Right.
Yeah.
But you weren't a movie star.
No, but I
yet.
Not yet, but I had did a couple movies, but...
But not the big one.
Not like the big one.
And then it took this long. This is like, that's a long time.
Yeah.
What was that about?
That was, I mean...
Was it my fault?
I think it was some of your fault.
You weren't mad at me, though?
No, I was not mad at you, no.
You weren't like, well, fuck that guy.
Never.
Well, that's
never,
nice.
Never, never.
So what was the book fair? What'd you do over there?
So I was at the Los Angeles Times book fair, and I did two stages there. One was a children's stage, and I read my book, Layla, The Last Black Unicorn, to the kids. And
you have a children's book.
I have a children's book called Layla, The Last Black Unicorn.
And you read the whole book?
The whole book.
How long did that take?
About 10 minutes.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and I was talking to the kids in between and stuff.
Now, what is the angle on The Last Black Unicorn?
Which one? Tiffany Haddish, The Last Black Unicorn?
No, the
or
children's
Layla?
Book.
Layla, The Last Black Unicorn. The angle on that is it's a story from when I was a kid and how I was getting, like, kind of bullied and picked on a little. Not too extensively in the book, but just a little bit to show, like, you know, you go to school to figure out who you are, like to figure out like you're special. There's something unique and awesome about you. You just got to figure out what that is.
Yeah.
Layla's thing was, you know, they went on a field trip in the Overlook Woods where she's from, which is South Central LA. And they got a little lost and she knew her way around there because that's where she's from.
Ah.
And they were calling her Woodsy, which is my way of saying ghetto.
Uh-huh.
But she knew her way around there. And she could help them find their way.
Oh.
And that's what made her special.
And
she was the only black unicorn.
And then all the other kids liked her?
And then all the other kids liked her.
And thought she was special. You know, I've never really talked to you, and I know you've told your story, and now your story's in a book.
Yes.
But I want to know, the one thing I noticed when I was, like, looking around is I need to know... About your, is it, how do you say it, attrition?
Eritrea?
Eritrea.
Yeah,
Eritrean.
Eritrean.
Now, I'm not dumb, but I don't know anything about it.
You don't know anything about Eritrea?
No.
So it is right next to Ethiopia.
And it was part of Ethiopia?
At one point in time, it was a part of Ethiopia. It was all Ethiopia, named by the colonizers.
Yes.
And, they fought for their independence. It took 30 years.
Yeah.
And now they're Eritrea.
And you're a citizen.
Country. Yes, I am.
So, like, and you've been there many times?
Well, 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because your dad's from there?
Yes.
What was, I don't mean to start with this experience, but I don't know anything about that part of the world.
Well, it is, feels like California, weather-wise.
It does.
Yes. Weather-wise, it feels like California. It is very beautiful. It's feels like, well, when I first got there, I felt like I was walking into a time capsule because it's kind of paused in time.
What made you go?
To bury my father.
That's it. And had you guys been getting along?
Yeah, we have been getting along for the most part. I mean, the last few months of his life, he was kind of mean to me and kind of pushing me away. And I guess he didn't want me to see him the way he was. And so.
But yeah. Like, was he always part of your life?
No, he was not always a part of my life. No. He came into my life when I was 27. Well, he was in my life till I was 3, and then he went away. And then...
Where'd he go?
All over America. He was, like, on the run. He was selling green cards illegally, and my mom told him she was going to tell on him and all this stuff. And so he went on the run. And
this was the Jewish guy?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he was an African Jew?
African Jew.
That must go way back. What do you know about it? Did you ever do Finding Your Roots?
No, I didn't do Finding My Roots.
Oh, you should do it.
I did 23andMe.
Yeah, I know.
And I know all my aunties and stuff, all his relatives and everything over there.
How'd the Jews get there?
The Jews have been there in Ethiopia.
Isn't that wild?
Know? You know, they have been there.
For like,
you know,
since that, I mean, the Bible.
Yeah, since the Bible. And, you know, there was that great exodus in the late 90s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Late 80s.
Of African Jews?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just, like, I'm so unfamiliar with it. Like, but was he a religious guy?
No, he wasn't a very religious guy.
But he was Jewish.
But he was very religious, I guess, when he first got to America and then wasn't that religious and then got on some drugs and stuff and alcohol real bad. And then the Christians helped him get cleaned up, so he would call himself a Christian Jew.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But were there rituals like that? I mean, are there African Jewish rituals?
They're the same as the regular Jewish. The same as the regular Jewish rituals.
Well, sometimes like there's a little.
No, there's like a little something a little different here. Maybe with the bun, you know, with the buna, with the coffee and whatnot. But frankincense maybe.
But you weren't brought up Jewish.
No, I was brought up Jehovah's Witness and then like just Baptist. I lived with a lot of different people for a while.
Where did you grow up mostly?
In South Central LA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How many brothers and sisters?
I got 2 sisters and 2 brothers. How many brothers and sisters you got?
One. Younger.
Brother?
Yeah.
Oh.
He's all right.
Yeah.
I get along with him.
Is he married?
Yeah.
Oh.
Why?
No reason. Just
nosy. He's actually not married. He's with somebody though. He's been married a couple times.
Oh, okay.
So like, but so you just brought up by your mom mostly?
Mostly by my mom and my grandma. Mm-hmm. And I had a stepdad for a little while. And
but it wasn't good. Things weren't good.
Things weren't necessarily great.
Yeah.
And you know, he was a veteran.
The stepdad?
So, yeah, the stepdad was a veteran in the Vietnam War, so he wasn't really, you know.
Yeah. And your mom?
And my mom was not in the Vietnam War. She's a veteran of South Central LA, I guess.
Yeah.
And she worked at the post office. She met him when she was working at the post office.
And, yeah. And then it was just happily ever after?
No, it was not happily ever after. A long, drawn out saga over there, boy.
What was it?
It was, I guess, a relationship that went bad.
Yeah.
And, it was not the best. And my mom had a really bad car accident. Her head went through a windshield. And
oh, my God.
She had to learn how to walk and talk and all that stuff all over again. And everything that she had taught me up to that point, I was, like, teaching her and helping her. But she still, you know, she loved her husband. And they
even
ended
after
up having,
all that?
Even after all of that.
He there for her?
No.
Oh.
No.
Isn't relationships crazy?
Yeah, relationships suck.
I mean, I don't understand sometimes.
I don't understand either. I mean, I would love to have like a partner to share my success with, my ups and my downs with, you know, and I like to share their ups and downs as well.
Yeah. But it's hard, right?
It's really hard.
You
don't know what people's real intentions are and stuff.
Is that what it is?
That, and it's like, you know.
I guess when you get to a certain level, you think that. I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't trust people in general.
I mean, I was always pretty trusting. I mean, I'm trusting you now. I'm here all by myself. And you're a white man, an older white man. And you know, I'm in your garage.
Quite a garage. It's a studio.
It's a studio.
And you kind of know me. We have friends.
I do know you. I do know you.
Yeah.
And people know that I'm here. So.
Oh, would you stop?
I've been watching some Netflix documentaries. I'm sorry.
Which ones?
Yeah, I'd rather not say.
Oh, really? Did you?
Well, I just watched that Locked Up. Was it Locked In or something like that?
Yeah.
Where they like let them out of their cells.
You should watch that. Baby Reindeer.
I just was talking with someone about this today.
Did you watch it?
No, I haven't watched it. They were telling me I need to watch it.
It's pretty heavy, man.
Yeah. There's like very little comedy in it, but it's...
The guy's a comedian, yeah. And I guess it's based on a show he did in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like gnarly, dude. I mean, it's like fucking...
Yeah, they were saying he was like drugged and raped by the guy he was doing the script with and like...
Something like that. Like, yeah, it's a big, long, you know, very courageous fucking thing, man. To like reveal that part of yourself as a story.
Yeah.
And then to be a comic. No, it's not funny. It's definitely not funny, but it's intense.
Yeah, the lady that was telling me about it, she's like, he's a comedian, but it's not really, you know, it's not in the comedy realm, but you have to watch. You just have to see it. Because it's just, he's really revealing so much.
Yeah.
Just revealing so much. And it kind of reminds me of your book, how you're just revealing so much. Like, you don't have to tell people these things. And I'm like, but I want to share these things so that, you know, people don't make the same mistakes that I did. That they, if they have made those mistakes, that they understand they're not alone.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, you're not the only person that's stupid.
Do you feel uncomfortable with any of it? Like, you know, now that you've written it, do you feel like, oh, I don't know?
Yeah, not really.
No?
Not really. I mean, I'm down to talk about it, but like a lot of it, it's funny because the first book I wrote, the intention of the book was to like put it in a book and never have to talk about it again.
Which book was that?
Tiffany Haddish, The Last Black Unicorn. But then you have to talk about all that stuff again when you do the press.
Yeah. And what was that one about?
That was about me. And like,
but this is about you.
In this next book is more about me. You know, you're supposed to write about what you know about.
Yeah, I know. But so was the other one mostly earlier life?
More earlier life. And like this one is like some earlier life stuff, but like just picking up where the last one left off. And like I put things in this next book and I Curse You With Joy. I put the stuff of, you know, that I didn't put in the first book, that I took out of the first book because I felt like it was too long.
Yeah.
And the through line of the book is like, what's really great about it is this, it is a series of essays and you could open up to any chapter.
Oh,
and
it's easier to write that way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so much easier to write that way. And it's a series where you can like open up any chapter and be like, okay, yeah, I get it.
Beginning, middle, end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as opposed to the first book is like kind of chronological.
Yeah.
You know, but this book is more like, oh, I can get in here, get in there. And it's like basically talking about everything that's happened. A lot of the things, not everything, but a lot of the things that's happened since Girls Trip came out.
Yeah, yeah. So the first book was all the childhood?
Childhood, adult life, you know.
Yeah.
Leading up to Girls Trip.
Yeah. And like, when did you start? You have to do it for me because like, I don't really know the story totally. Mm-hmm. I think the only part of the story is that I remember hearing several times that you slept in your car.
Yeah. Yeah, I was homeless for a while.
That was the part I heard.
Yeah.
And then, like, I just built my own imagination around that.
What did you build around that?
I'm like,
I want to hear.
Well, I was like, well, that's sad. She was living in her car, and she had family in Los Angeles. It must have been terrible. And I don't know how she got to her car, but she must have loved doing comedy.
I did. I love doing comedy.
But how'd you end up in the car?
I was standing at my grandma's house, and my mom got... Okay, so... The first time I turned, you know, 18, the state stopped paying for me. I didn't go to college like I was supposed to.
Yeah.
I got accepted in NYU and all this, and I didn't go because I didn't want to leave my sisters and brothers behind. And my grandma's like, I'm not getting paid for you no more. You got to get out.
Oh, and all your siblings are younger?
And all of them are younger than me.
And your mom's what? She's not in the picture?
She's in the picture, but not in the picture. Like, we were still in foster care.
Yeah. Because of the car accident?
Yeah, well, she's schizophrenic.
Oh,
so she's not capable of, but like, that's what they diagnosed her with. I think it's more like CT or something like that. But
what's that?
You know, the football player
thing.
Oh, you know?
Right. The hemorrhaging in the brain. What, did she hallucinate and stuff?
Mm-hmm. She hears voices, hallucinates, gets very violent.
That all happened because of the car accident?
Yeah.
God damn.
Yeah.
So it wasn't safe?
No, it was not safe.
You were just left to take care of all the other kids?
Yeah, well, I looked out for them as best I could. Yeah, did what I could.
You were a kid. Yeah.
Yeah, I was a kid.
And then your grandma took you in.
And then my grandma, well, we went into foster care and I moved around a lot. I don't know about my sister. I don't think they moved around too much.
To other foster care places?
Mm-hmm.
So you had families that took you in?
Mm-hmm. And then a group home and a facility.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, facility first, then a couple of homes, and then group home. And
were any of the families good people?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But it must be odd, right?
It was weird. Like, yeah, because
you're
like
already
an uncomfortable slumber party. Kind of like getting an Airbnb and then people don't leave.
And you're like already a teenager.
Yeah. So trying to figure that out. And then by the time I was 15, my grandma got me.
Yeah.
And I was with her 14, 15, somewhere now.
Were you performing at all?
No.
Doing anything?
Just drama in school.
Yeah.
And then once my social worker is like, you know, you got two choices this summer. You can either do the Laugh Factory Comedy Camp or you can do psychiatric therapy because something is wrong with your child. And
what they think was wrong with you?
Well, I had these imaginary friends that I would talk to. I would get in trouble a lot for doing, you know, talking in class.
Do you remember the imaginary friends?
Yes, Carbolita and Polly. It was actually Cracker. It was a bird named Cracker.
And did you know why you created them?
Yeah, to make everybody laugh.
So it wasn't a real thing.
I mean, I couldn't see them.
Right.
But I made it seem
but
like
But you knew they weren't real.
I knew they weren't real. It was
a shtick?
It was a shtick to get attention and to
make
other people laugh. Yeah, it did work. I would be like, because I went to a predominantly white junior high and high school.
Where at?
In Woodland Hills. I got bussed out to Woodland Hills.
Bussed out?
Yeah.
That was the way it worked?
My mom had put me in a choices program.
Yeah.
And so they sent me to Hell Middle School and El Camino Real High School.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good. That's a good thing?
Yeah, that was a great thing. It's funny because once we went into foster care, I kept going to the school and the police kept showing up and stuff because I was considered AWOL because I was supposed to go to a school in the community.
Yeah.
But I chose to keep going to my school. So I would catch the RTD all the way to the school. It'd be like 3 hours.
Oh, my God.
From South Central on the RTD. And it was kind of a great experience because I got to see like all the different communities. You would see like the bus change, like the demographic change on the bus every few miles.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm like, oh, this is where all the Asian people live. Oh, right. This is where all the white people live. Oh, this is where the Mexican people live. This is where the black people live. This is where, like, oh, it's a lot of white people on Ventura. Like, you know, it's like on Ventura Boulevard. It was like, whoa.
Yeah.
A lot of older people here, a lot of this there. Like, so I got to learn the demographic of Los Angeles and got to learn my way around. And I still would get to school on time. I get up at like 4 a.m.
That's fucking crazy.
And then finally, I had to go in front of the judge and like ask permission to go to my school.
The judge did?
Yeah, I had to ask permission from the judge to go to the school. And the judge was like, why are you keep doing it? Like, you know, you should be going to this school. Why are you going to that school? And I was like, well, I feel safest at this school. I like it there. I really want to go to this school. This is the school I want to go to. I don't want to go to these other schools. And he was like, well, shucks, you know, like most kids don't even want to go to school. So the fact that you want to go, you can go to that school.
Oh, that's
like,
because, nice.
You know, I was state property at that point. So
because of the foster system?
Mm-hmm. You were state property at that point in the courts determined a lot of everything. Like for me to get a driver's license, I had the judge sign off on my driver's license for me to.
And that's not no fault of your own.
Mm-mm. And to be on the news, like once I got in the Laugh Factory Comedy Camp. To be on the news, I had to ask the judge permission to do that, and I had to plead why or I should be on the news and everything, and he was like, well, if you're half as funny as you are in this classroom, if you're just a little bit as entertaining as you are in this courtroom, then you know, you can go ahead and be on the news.
And the only reason was because you were under 18.
Well, yeah, and I was ward of the state property. So, and they didn't want, you know, they don't really let kids be on TV like that are in the foster care system because you might get kidnapped, you might give up your location, you know, stuff like that. And
But in looking back on it, do you feel like the foster care system served you?
I do feel like it served me. I mean, I think it would have been better just to be like with my grandma the whole time.
Yeah.
But I got to see how other people lived. I got to know what it's like to like have to pack up and get on really quick. Adapt to different environments. I think it prepared me for comedy in many ways.
Yeah. How did that? Well, how did that
me
work?
For the road, anyways.
Yeah. Well, right, to travel. But yeah. I mean, but how did it work? Like families would just say, you know, they'd only take you for a certain amount of time.
Well, the courts determine how long you get to stay in a place.
The
social worker would, you know, find a home for you, whatever.
Yeah.
You get to a certain age, you can't be there no more. And you move.
So you couldn't get many.
And if I come home from school and my stuff would be in a trash bag at the front door.
What?
Maybe, you know, it could be something with the family. If for me, I thought that nobody wanted me. You know, and that's not necessarily the case. It could be just, you know, you've aged out of this type of home.
Huh.
Or, you know, or the courts they're not letting them do that. Or maybe the foster parents only want babies now. Or it just, you never know.
Do you keep in touch with any of the foster people?
No. No.
No. Wasn't that good an experience?
Hell no.
Yeah. But so when your grandma finally takes you, you can still go to Woodland Hills to the school?
Yeah.
And that's where you, what, that's where you started to be entertaining?
Yeah, I was entertaining, for sure. Junior high, high school, yeah, for sure entertaining. I was a class clown, both both junior high and high school.
Did you do all right in school?
It was not the best. I mean, I did what I could, though. I did what I could.
Yeah? Well, how'd you end up getting into NYU?
For drama. I was a gifted student of dramatic arts. I was winning all these drama festivals for monologues. And
started out in Woodland Hills?
Mm-hmm. And it was like for all of Southern California, all the schools in Southern California. And I would beat, like, I remember I won a monologue competition, and I beat like 500 and some students, and it was crazy because it was not easy. But and I got to perform at Paramount Pictures. That was like the prize. You get to perform in front of all these agents and managers and stuff at Paramount, and people wanted to represent me then. But you know, because I was in foster care, my grandma was like, "Nah, you can't do that." And
shit, away. Really? So they wanted they were ready to go.
Yeah, they were ready to go with me. I mean, I had some skills.
Yeah. Did you take classes or was it all just instinctual?
I was in the drama class. I was in a drama class and, you know, I paid attention in there because it was like, ooh. The only reason I got in the drama class is because there was this boy named Adi in there. And I thought, ooh, he black, I'm black. The school was only 3% black. I'm like, we're going to have to kiss. They're going to have to put us together. And Adi going to be my boyfriend. But my drama teacher at that school was very open-minded and liberal.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she did the interracial couple thing. I was very upset. I'm like, when racism doesn't work in your favor.
But did you like this teacher? I mean,
I did. That was Miss Young. I did like her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, I did.
Do you give them credit?
I give her credit for, you know, that was junior high. In high school, my teacher, Miss Greeb, I think I called her Miss Gear or something like that in the book, try to protect her.
Yeah.
But she realized I couldn't read that well. And so she had me come into her class and like reading to her every day. She helped me
before class kind of thing?
Like during like lunchtime, nutrition.
Right. Yeah.
Like I would come in there and read to her for like a whole semester.
And it worked? Helped?
It worked. It helped a lot. It helped a lot.
Yeah. And she was an acting teacher?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what did she show you?
Just, you know, she helped me with the sounding out of the words and stuff. Yeah. Like, I knew letters, but I didn't understand, like, how they went together. The English language, so fucking complicated. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. But in acting terms, how'd she help you?
Oh, well, she helped me find my confidence in stage. I know the difference between stage left, stage right.
Yeah.
You know, all those different things. And just, you know, performing, willing to be silly.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay to be silly and
were
goofy.
You serious at first?
No. I was goofy as hell, but show me how. It was a comedy camp, though. That really showed me when to be funny, when not to be funny, how to put a joke together, the who, what, when, where's, why.
Were you watching comedy already?
Yeah, I was already watching comedy. I was already watching like Def Jam and Comic View and stuff
that.
Yeah. Whose Line Is It Anyways? The improv. We used to have comedy sports at my school. So we would do, like, I was on the comedy sports team and we would do stuff.
In high school?
Yeah. They went away to competitions and stuff. I didn't go to the competitions.
Because you couldn't?
I don't know why I didn't, but I just didn't.
Were you pretty good at the improv?
Yeah, I was very good at it.
Yeah.
Very good.
So once you like moved in with your grandmother, then she said it was okay to do the comedy camp?
Yeah, she said it was okay. Well, the social worker got me in a comedy camp.
How about that social worker? You like them?
Yeah, I do like her. Yeah. Yes, I do. I like her a lot.
And she was with you the whole time?
Not the whole entire time, but majority.
When you got older?
Yeah, majority of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you felt like she gave a shit? And
I definitely felt like she cared and like, she wasn't perfect, but who is? Nobody.
Right. Tough job.
Yeah, very, not easy job at all.
Yeah, they don't get as much, you know, attention as they should.
No.
Like, I don't know why there's... I tried to pitch a TV show about social workers, and it didn't go, but it seems like that's the most, like, intense, important job in the world.
I did, too.
Yeah.
I did too. I don't know why I didn't go either.
Yeah, I don't think people know what they really do, but they're like, you know, they're the ones on the ground dealing with this shit.
Yeah.
Taking care of fucking kids and people and families.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Dealing with all kind of like violence and abuse and so much hard shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she was all right, huh?
She was all right.
Did you thank her when you got successful?
I did.
What would you do?
I did. I called her and said thank you. It's funny because when I got emancipated and I finally got an apartment, I moved into this really cool apartment complex in Culver City.
Yeah.
I was working at the airlines and I moved in and she was staying in the same complex. And I was like, oh my gosh, hey girl. Hey. Like, she thought I was like coming to like do something to her.
Stalking
I'm
her.
Like, no, I live here. She was like, what? You live here? You can afford to live here? And I'm like, yeah, I work at the airlines. And I got a roommate. And,
what airlines you work at?
I worked at Alaska Airlines.
Really?
Yeah, I worked at a few airlines. Actually, I started at American, then I went to Air New Zealand, and then I went to Alaska.
Doing what?
Customer service.
Oh.
The best customer service agent you ever met.
Did you get to fly all for free and shit?
Yeah, you know, like discounted rate, paid a tax.
But this is when you're doing comedy already.
Yeah, I was doing stand-up, but not like hardcore. Well, yeah, once I turned 21, I really got into it.
So
I started at the airlines at like 19.
So tell me about like, but this is after the car, obviously. Like, how do you end up in your car at comedy camp?
Not at comedy camp. I ended up in my car once I was emancipated.
Okay.
So, my grandma puts me out. I didn't have a car yet. And then,
But tell me about comedy camp.
Oh, comedy camp was great. So, I remember the first day Charles Fleischer showed up.
Out of all the people.
Charles Fleischer, who was like my favorite because I loved Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I still love that movie.
He's such a weird act.
Man, nobody knows his real voice. He's always talking in a different character
voice.
And
he's always like hunched over. And by that point, he was kind of older.
He wasn't that much older. He's probably like maybe a few years younger than you.
He wasn't younger than me then. What year are we talking?
We talking 1996.
No, he was, okay, maybe he was 60, I don't know.
60? I thought he was like 60-something now.
No.
How old is he now?
You really want to know?
Yeah. Because he's like a, you know, science genius, mathematical genius.
He just won some awards
and stuff. Like,
did he?
He does awesome artwork he does.
He's 73.
Yeah, so he was like in his 40s then.
Wow.
Yeah, he had to be in his 40s because that was almost 30 years ago.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, 96.
So, like, because I was a doorman at the Comedy Store in 87, and I used to see him around. So, I always felt older to me.
Probably because he talked with older voices and stuff.
Yeah, and he's all hunched over. And
maybe he has.
Yeah, and he always heard these things that he was, some sort of genius. He invented some sort of crayon. I remember that.
Yeah, protractor kind of a thing.
I don't know. He had this multicolored thing he'd draw with. And so that's your first exposure? Like,
him and the Wayans brothers came in there, David Alan Greer, Tom Dreesen. Who else came in there? Dane Cook showed up. Dane Cook was a little bit after comedy camp because I was still going up there and like doing stuff.
So what was the structure of the thing?
It was you come in there, everybody sits down.
It's just kids?
It's just kids ages 8 to 18.
Yeah.
And you would go on stage, you would do like 3 minutes, tell a story or some funny jokes.
Yeah.
And then the comedians that mentored the class would like give you advice. I remember one class, Richard Pryor came into the class.
Come on.
And I'm on stage and he's in this wheelchair. So I'm like, dang, I gotta get a wheelchair. That's what rich people got, wheelchairs. Like, that's what I was thinking. So stupid. And I was on stage telling my jokes, and he goes, Stop. What are you doing? I said, I'm telling a joke. He goes, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. He goes, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. He goes, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. What do you think I'm doing? He said, you're getting on my goddamn nerves. That's what you're doing. Now, look, people don't come to comedy shows because they want to hear about your problems or politics or religion. They come to have fun. So when you're on stage, you need to be having fun. If you're having fun, they're having fun.
Richard Pryor said that.
Mm-hmm. So you need to be having fun. And I kind of took that. I didn't understand it in that moment, but as it's been my philosophy in life, try to have fun at everything I do. If I have fun at everything, then life will be like not as hard.
Do you think that did you feel like you were being too serious, or that you were just working too hard, or what do you think?
I was being really hacky and like trying to, I don't know what the heck I was trying to
do.
I was the funniest kid in class. I mean, everybody laughed at my stuff. And I would like do, I remember the first day, Charles Fleischer told me, don't do bathroom humor, because I was doing jokes about, I was doing jokes about like older women using the bathroom and how like gross they sound when they use the bathroom. Like when I go to public restrooms, it's so gross. I think the joke was like, you ever go to a public restroom and you in there trying to use the bathroom and some old lady walk in and you know it's an old lady because she in there talking about some, making all those noises and stuff. Gross, old lady. And you try not to laugh, but you can't help but to laugh because she just like passing gas and stuff. You nasty old lady. And he was telling me, don't do that. I'm a pretty girl. You shouldn't talk about toilet stuff. You shouldn't talk about the toilet because you're pretty.
I like how you were able to lock right back into that bit.
Because now I do it. And I'm like, you ever realize you old when you go to the public bathroom and you just making all kind of noises trying to take your clothes off?
You do it.
Now I'm that old lady. Now I'm the old gross lady.
So now it's okay to do it because it's from your point of view.
Yeah, but it was from my point of view then, too.
Yeah, but you weren't the old lady.
No, I wasn't.
You're just making fun of an old lady.
Making fun of the old lady.
Now you're making fun of yourself.
I'm like, why is she passing gas in the bathroom? Gross.
Well, you got to do it somewhere.
Why is she taking a deuce? Gross.
Where she
stinks. Pull your panties back up.
You got to do it somewhere.
Now I know better.
You learned.
I mean, I was like 15, 16 years old then. Like, I didn't know no better.
You learned your lesson. Mm-hmm. You became that lady.
I became that lady. Thank God. I've lived long enough to become that lady.
How long was the comedy camp?
The comedy camp was all summer. So like 8 weeks.
Oh, so 3 weeks. Months. Oh, yeah.
Like 8 weeks, maybe.
And that was enough to give you the bug for real?
That was enough. I mean, it was the first time like a man ever like gave me a hug and I didn't feel like, it was the first time a man told me I was beautiful and that I was smart, that I was talented. Like I felt seen.
Yeah.
I really didn't have that kind of attention from men where I felt safe. Like I actually felt safe and I felt safest on stage. And I was like, oh, this might be something I do for the rest of my life. I don't know. And then I would keep coming up there every summer. And I would, like, come do, like, certain, like, Tuesday nights, do the open mic or something like that.
That is interesting, though, that feeling of, like, that the stage is the safest place. I've been thinking a lot about that lately.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, like, how am I able to talk like this to these people? I don't fucking know these people. And I don't have any fear about it. And I know that you are being seen. It is your space. And no one can fuck with you.
Yeah, well, because you got witnesses. I felt like, because I have witnesses, like if something happens, I have people to witness it. That say, hey, yeah, that man, he tried to hurt her up there. This happened to her.
Did that ever happen?
Well, a guy did pull a gun out on me one time on stage.
But, really?
Yeah.
Where?
At the Laugh Factory.
Holy shit.
That was a long time ago. He was really drunk.
Yeah, but he had the gun.
But he had the gun.
Not a good combination.
No, and they put him out.
Yeah.
Like, they put him
out. That's good.
Yeah.
they must have been nervous about kicking him out.
Didn't seem like it.
Yeah? Just they got it. They converged on him.
Got him and got him out of there.
So you went to the comedy camp a few years in a row?
Yeah, well, no. Well, I just popped up to the comedy camp like a mentor, you know?
Right, right.
And I'm a kid and I came from here. And like Amanda Bynes graduated from it. And like, you know. So it was cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So after you graduate high school?
So after I graduated high school, I stopped doing the comedy because I was homeless and I was like kind of couch surfing. And
your grandma just put you out?
Put me out.
Huh.
Put me out. She wasn't getting paid for me no more. So I got the job at the airlines and I got a car like right away. And then I was there for a while. I was doing pretty good. And then by the time I was 21, right before I turned 21, like, bam, homeless again. Because the place where I was staying, they were selling it. We had to leave. And so I had to leave, and I didn't have anywhere to go. And so I was like sitting up at the social worker's office because it's still like part of the system. I was in an independent living program. And so they had to find a place for me. I was like washing my ass in their bathroom and like sitting in their office. So I had to go to work and everything. And then they got me a place. They found me a place and then I was good. And then I left from there. Then I moved to my grandma, like one of my grandma's properties. I was paying her rent that my mom got in the hospital again. And my grandma was like, you know, I'm going to choose my daughter over you. You got friends. You're going to be all right. And so I was shooting my very first movie then, too. And
where'd you go when she said that, when your mom went?
And she put me out again. She put my stuff on the porch and stuff. And so got all my stuff, packed it up in the car, got a storage bin or a storage place, put most of my stuff in the storage. And then I was like in my car. And when we were filming the movie, it's so funny, when we were filming the movie.
Which movie?
This, I'd rather you not say. And so I was filming the movie.
Okay.
I was like sleeping wherever the next day, you know, where we were going to be shooting. I was sleeping in that parking lot, you know, outside and just wait till, you know, the crew got there. And then I go in and like wash up in the bathroom or whatever and like and do the movie.
Did they know?
They did not know.
You didn't have a trailer?
I didn't have a trailer. This was a very low budget film. They were supposed to pay me $1,200. They never did pay me.
Never paid you?
No, they never paid me my money. One of the producers gave me a bunch of DVDs and was like, sell these.
Oh my God.
It's so messed up. And then like, it ended up being in like the African Film Festival or whatever.
Yeah.
At the Magic Johnson Theater. And I remember like, oh, I invited all my friends to the premiere. And barely anybody came, and I was like, got myself all dressed up and stuff, like my movie premiere. And then the movie was horrible, and like
really bad.
It was really bad.
How were you?
I was okay.
Yeah,
but the movie was really bad.
Yeah,
I was definitely. You could tell I was new, and it was my very first movie.
But you got one under your belt.
Got one under my belt, and then finally got a place. And
were you doing comedy?
Mm-hmm. I was doing stand-up then, too. Because I kind of had like a breakdown, like a nervous breakdown. Because I had stopped doing comedy when I was like 19. I stopped and then had a breakdown. And then
how'd that go?
It was bad. It was kind of bad.
And I ended up in therapy. Oh, in therapy.
Ended up in psychiatric therapy. And a therapist was like, what makes you happy? And I'm like, hearing people laugh makes me happy. Like hearing like a group of people laugh is like really dope. And she's like, why don't you get back to doing comedy as a hobby? So I go do an open mic and this comedian sees me and he's like, yo, I would love for you to do one of my shows. I'm doing this show. It's like a women's conference thing. You should do it. It pays $50. You just got to do 15 minutes. I was like, what? Hell yeah, I'm there. And I went and did it. I bombed terribly. Like, I bombed hard. And I was like, so, because it ended up being like a lesbian show or whatever. Oh. And all I had was like jokes about my boyfriend and stuff. And they were like heckling me and I didn't know how to handle it. And I struggled, but I stayed up there the whole 15 minutes because I wanted my money, right? And then they gave me the light. I came off the stage, and the guy's like,
here's some DVDs.
He gave me my $50, and I was like, whoa, you paying me? He was like, yeah. He was like, you struggled up there, but you know, keep at it. And he gave me my $50. I was like, what?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And then I still got paid.
And then, but where are you living then?
Then I was living I was in an independent living program.
Good.
And then I had to leave that program. And then, I was homeless again. And,
were you living in your car when you were doing spots at the factory?
Uh-huh.
And you just park what over in that parking lot?
Uh-huh. Park in the parking lot over there.
Did you sleep over there?
Sometimes. Not too often because I didn't want nobody to really know. I didn't want people to think like, oh, damn, she's, you know.
When did they homeless. Figure it out?
When I started telling, like, you know, you tell one comedian something, they tell every motherfucking body. Can't tell them shit.
And did they start taking care of you at least?
Not really. Not really. No, not really. No, Kevin looked out for me though. He saw the stuff in my car. It's funny because some comics would be like, you could stay at my place. You could stay, but like, I've heard like stories about them and they, with, like, the energy wasn't cool.
And, Kevin Hart?
No, not Kevin Hart's energy wasn't cool.
No, but he saw you?
Yeah, he saw all the stuff in my car, and he was like, what's going on here, Tiffany? What's up? Like, what's going on with this? Look like you homeless or something. I'm like, oh, no, I'm in between places right now. Like, yeah, you know, like, he was like, we're going to have to talk about this. I'm like, no, I don't need to talk about it. And then, you know.
Did you talk about it?
Yeah, we talked about it. He caught me before I, like, jumped in the car, and we talked about it. And he gave me, like, $300 and said, like, get yourself a place to stay for the month, which I don't know where you could get a place for a month in.
For $300?
Nowhere. And I had a couple hundred dollars already. And I went and got a room at, like, the Snooty Fox, and he told me to, you know, write out a list of goals, like, and start, like, doing something every day towards those goals.
He's already been a motivational guy.
Already. And so I wrote out my list of goals, and, yeah, I went to the Snooty Fox. I stayed there for, like, 3 hours and took, like, a nap or whatever, left from there, got a call, like, hey, there's this guy, he has this place, you want to check it out? I'm like, oh, shoot, yeah, like, well, how did you know I need a place? Like, and I'm like, oh, wait, Kevin, I told Kevin, okay, whatever, shut up. And when I looked at the place, and it was, like, looked like a total crack house.
Yeah.
Like, it looked really fucked up. There's roaches. The walls was yellow. It looked like it was bad. The carpet was dirty. It was nasty.
Yeah.
And I just looked around and was just like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's perfect. I'll take it. Like, and the rent was like $500 a month. And I worked out a deal with the landlord, like, hey, if I fix it up, can I not pay a security deposit? And he's like, sure. And so I fixed it up, like, got the carpet changed and all this stuff, whatever.
Yeah.
And I still have that place.
Really?
I still have it. It is since, like, 2005.
You live there?
I don't live there.
Yeah.
But I do spend a lot of time there. I do go there.
Huh. Why is that?
Because I turned it into a closet.
Oh.
Because it was not big.
So you're paying rent for a closet?
Paying rent for a closet. I had read somewhere that, like, I was letting, like, family stay there, friends would stay there, whatever. Yeah. But I had read that Beyonce, every time she wears something, she, like, archives it and puts it in storage, right?
Right.
In, like, this airtight storage place.
Yeah.
And when I tried to look into something like that, and I was like, oh, no, that costs too much money. I can't see myself doing that.
So you kept that place.
I kept that place.
But do you think you keep it as a reminder?
It does feel like when I go in there, it does remind me of where I come from.
Right.
And that, you know, that I've come a long way.
Yeah, it sounds
long,
like it.
A long, long way.
And where is it, Hollywood?
No, it's in South Central L.A. Well, in the West Adams District.
Oh, that's kind of nice sometimes, right?
Yes, well, not that street, but now that street is nice now.
Yeah.
Yeah, now it is.
Well, that's interesting that you keep it, but you have a house.
Yeah, I got a house.
And
sis.
You still keep it.
Houses.
Houses. So, but you still want to keep that place for the clothes?
I do. I do. Because it's like my own storage facility.
It seems deeper than that.
It is. I'm a hoarder.
Are you?
It's hoarding memories.
And so when you put the hoarding in some other place, it doesn't seem real?
I mean, it's not cluttered or nothing. I mean, it's nice.
Yeah. So when do you get the big break?
I get the big break. I guess, to me, my big break was in 2014 when I did the Arsenio Hall show, when they rebooted that. To me, that was my big break. To the world, my big break is when Girls Trip came out.
Yeah.
But I feel like I was doing it big. When,
were you just mostly doing the factory, or were you touring?
I was doing the factory. I was doing a comedy store occasionally. You know, Tommy was there, so it wasn't really like.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's when we first met.
Yeah.
That was like 2013, 2014.
Yeah.
And I toured. I did some stuff. Not like I would ask comics to take me on tour, and they would tell me no.
Really.
Or one comic is like, hey, you open your legs, you can open up for me. I'm like, I'm cool. I don't need that.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather not. Like, I'm going to subject myself to two possible bombs. Yeah. No, thank you.
Yeah. So you didn't go on tour with anybody?
No, I never toured with anybody like that. No.
Yeah.
I mean, did like a spot show here, maybe this thing there or whatever. But
was the first TV shot the Arsenio one?
No, the very first time I did stand up on TV was a Michael, I think it was Michael Basin show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what that is.
I know, because he's black. And it was on TV One, I think.
Yeah.
And then I did Who's Got Jokes. Before that, the very first time doing stand-up on TV was Who's Got Jokes. Bill Bellamy's Who's Got Jokes. And then I did, that was my first, like.
Were there black rooms then?
Yeah, there was black rooms, yeah.
Were you playing those?
Not really.
Huh.
Not really. Occasionally, like, but it was hard to get in there. Huh. It was hard to get a spot, period. I ended up creating my own room at this restaurant called The Palms that was like off of Overland.
Yeah.
And I created my own room and I called it Comedy Yoki. And yeah. I did it with this karaoke guy. So the comics would do like 5 to 10 minutes of jokes and then they would sing a song.
Oh, well, that's good.
Comedy Yoki.
Did people come?
Yeah, people came. And I did that for like a year and a half.
So after you, when did people start to know you?
People knew me. Like people knew me, but people wasn't really trying to give me a chance. Like,
were you getting
just
mad?
Just few comics. Yeah, I would get mad sometimes and be like, dang, maybe I should stop this. And like comics like Corey Holcomb would be like, you should just get pregnant by a rich man and just give up. Just, you're a pretty girl. Just get pregnant by somebody rich and just do that. You seem like you'd be a good mom. Just do that.
Yeah.
And I was working at a youth center teaching dance and I was the activities coordinator and I would take the kids to like TV show tapings and stuff. Like all the things I wanted to do, that's what I would take them to do.
Oh my
God. And we would go snowboarding and surfing and to like all these cool things, horseback riding.
Were you working for the city?
No, I was working for a youth center, called, a place called Home.
Where was that?
South Central LA.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the east side.
What was that? That must have been a rewarding gig.
It was. It was fun and it was sometimes stressful and sometimes you'd be like, ooh, it was good birth control, I think.
but like, at least you could entertain the kids.
Yeah, if you can make kids laugh, you can do anything.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, because they're very honest and like, brutal. And I would run jokes by them and stuff, and they'd be like, oh, that's funny. No, that's not funny. Oh, that sucks, Mr.
Were they right?
Yeah, they were right. They were always right.
So when does the comedy start taking off?
The comedy started taking off, I would say, by like 2008. It really started taking off then. Things really started moving.
And
I got like Best New Comic in LA by Los Angeles Magazine, and like I had done the Who's Got Jokes, and I did Def Comedy Jam by then. And
the Arsenio thing?
And Arsenio was in 2014.
Oh, so that's still a long ways away.
But I was getting gigs around the country and stuff, booking little stuff, and I was still doing bar and bat mitzvahs. So I was doing
that
comedy.
That was a gig you did?
Yeah, from the time I was like 16 till I was 27.
What would you do?
I was an energy producer, so my job. Yeah, my job was to produce great energy, like get people dancing, bring joy, have a good time. I would do activities.
Was that your own business, or was energy production business?
It was. I was with this company called Enterprise Entertainment.
That I've never even heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
You're like a warm up guy.
Yeah, I warmed up the whole room,
right.
Get the whole room dancing.
Yeah.
The DJ plays music, I get them dancing and stuff. I would do comedy sometimes. I would MC them sometimes, MC the whole party, say, drop little jokes here and there.
Get tips?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes, yeah.
That's a whole other racket.
I made good money. By the end, I was making like $2,500 a party. I think that's great racket.
That's great.
Yeah, I was getting requested and like, you know, doing all the sisters and brothers, all the like, you know, do whole families and stuff.
So you just get everyone dancing and get, and that's the same time you're doing comedy.
Same time doing comedy. So I had to do comedy like Monday through Thursday.
And then go energy produce.
Yeah, go energy produce. Sometimes we do like a day party on a Sunday. And then like I could do a, you know, chocolate Sundays or something like that at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah. And then, like, how do you get cast in that movie?
Which movie?
The one that made you huge.
Oh, Girls Trip?
Yeah, you did a few movies before that.
Yeah, I did a few movies before that. And when I did that movie, I did a Lifetime movie in New Orleans, and I worked with some people, and then I did another movie, Keanu, in New Orleans the year before in, like, 2015.
Well, what were most of these movies, small parts?
Small parts or major parts. Like in Keanu, I had a major role.
Right before that, but like some of these, I don't know what they are. Boosters, Christmas Wedding.
Okay, Boosters. Play. Boosters was like a movie. You know Melanie Camacho?
Yeah.
She's a comedian. She wanted to do a movie, and so I helped her with her movie. I did a little part in it. Yeah. I'd already did Girls Trip, but I was like, and Girls Trip hadn't come out yet. So
I
was helping my friend out. I did a lot of stuff like that, helping my friend out.
Oh, so some of these are shorts. Yeah. I see some of the videos. Yeah,
yeah. Christmas Wedding is like a skit that I did with Natasha Leggero.
Oh, yeah. So you're kind of in the mix with all the people?
Yeah, I did a lot of sketches. A lot of sketches.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember, I want to say that it was...
For like Funny or Die and shit?
Yeah, a lot of stuff for Funny or Die. So many sketches. It's funny, none of them are up anymore.
Well,
anyways,
is that site still up?
I think the site is still up. Last I checked, well, last time I looked at it was like last year, and the site was still up, and it was only just a few of the sketches that I did were still up.
Yeah.
Because it was a different time back then, you know?
Oh, so, in terms of the subject matter.
Yeah, it's a different time. But it's funny. What's that comic? I want to say his name, and I can't think of his name right now. And I know you know him very well because he gives weed and sometimes...
Tripoli?
Yep, Sam Tripoli. You knew who I was talking about. So Sam Tripoli was saying to me, and I met him when I was really young, like 22 or something, and 23. And Sam was like, you know, if you want to make it in this business, you're going to have to develop relationships with comics. And Elon Gold, too. Both of them were talking to me, and they're like, you got to develop relationship with comics because that's like
the both ends of the spectrum, there. Right? Tripoli and Gold. You know,
And Elon was like, you know, most of your work is going to come from comedians. So get to know them, especially the ones that write. That's where most of your work's going to come from. And he was correct. A lot of my stand-up shows and stuff that I ended up doing, it was through other comics. And, like, I auditioned for that Keanu movie. I got that. And then I made friends with a lot of the, like, crew, right? And hung out with them and did comedy shows while I was in New Orleans and invite them to the comedy shows.
Yeah.
We would go out and stuff. And then...
And did you meet those guys, too? Key and Peele.
Yeah, I met them. Yeah. And it was so funny because the crew from the Keanu movie, a lot of them got hired to do Girls Trip. And they were like, yo, they're looking for a girl to fill this part in. You would be perfect. You should, you know, check this out. And like eight different crew members like sent me this script. Like, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. Like, I don't want to get in trouble.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
This should be you.
Yeah.
And I was like reading the script. I'm like, yo, who was with us last summer? Who wrote this? Like, you know, like who was with us? Who knows me?
Yeah.
And, I auditioned, like, I had to get on my agent, like, give me an audition for this movie. And they're like, oh, no, they're not. They only want names. I said, well, I've had a name since 1979, and it's Tiffany motherfucking Haddish. Get me in there. So I get in there, and I had to, like, pre-read with, like, the assistant to the casting director, then the casting director's actual assistant, then the actual casting director. And then I did a producer's audition, and then finally they had me go to directors, and then I got the part. Yeah. But I didn't know I got the part till like, you know, 3 days before it was time to shoot.
Really?
Yeah, I had like 3 days to get my everything in order and get to New Orleans.
Oh, my God. Do you still have that agent?
No.
Yeah.
But we are still friends. It's funny, all the things that I've ever fought for have been worth fighting for.
Yeah.
So it's made a change, a difference. But I feel like I'm still the same person.
Yeah.
Just living a little better lifestyle.
Yeah.
I'm not ever going to be homeless again.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you're going to keep that apartment for your clothes.
Yeah, because I'll never be homeless. Neither will my clothes.
So after a Girls Trip, the whole fucking world changes.
Yeah, everybody's attitude changes. I mean, not that much, because I already had like a lot of people love me and care for me. You know,
but I just mean in terms of your public profile, right?
My public profile like explodes. Blew up. Yeah.
Could you handle it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like, it felt like high school times 10.
Right.
Like, and it is high school times 10, the way they talk about you and all this stuff. Like, now they think they're talking about you behind your back, but it's on social media, and it's like, as soon as I Google my name, I see what you said, bro.
How the fuck can you handle that? Like, that one set where you bombed and it just became this viral shit show.
Yeah, I was like, yo, every comedian bombs. Like, what the hell is going on? Like, it's funny, because Sinbad called me and said, you made it. You made it, Tiffany Haddish. You're a star. That means you're a star. I'm like, really? Like, one bad day at work and this is what happens?
Where was that?
It was in Miami.
Oh, it's the worst.
It was the worst. And I'm just like, wow, you know.
Someone just taped it?
They had, like, got little bits and pieces of it. Like, it was not a horrible show the whole time. But I was not my regular self. I was definitely very sick. I had alcohol poisoning. A part of me wants to say somebody drugged me, but who's the somebody? It's probably me.
Yeah.
I mean, but I've never felt that horrible
the day after drinking. Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever. I've never felt like that in my whole life.
Oh, so you're sweaty and fucked up.
I was so sick, like so sick.
Yeah.
Like just like I thought my organs had fell out my ass. Like my kidneys, liver, everything felt like it was just.
Oh my God.
I was feeling so like I was dead.
Yeah, yeah.
you know?
And the set was just the fucking worst.
It was the worst. I was like on autopilot, not really giving much energy. Like I tried at first, like tried it, and it was like my soul was like, bye, bitch, I can't do this.
That's the worst. I can't when the soul leaves you.
Yeah, my soul left, and I was just like,
just watching you from the side of the room.
Yeah, and then I was just like, people have been telling me all day, like, oh, just drink a little bit of vodka today. Like, you'll feel better. If you just hair of the dog. And I was just like, oh, my God, I cannot. And then by the end of the set, I'm like, somebody bring me that bottle of Ciroc. Like, bring me that vodka. And it was New Year's Eve. So I'm like, anybody want some alcohol? And I was like giving people, pouring in their cups. And then the last little bit, I like drank. And then it was funny. Everybody took pictures of that. Like, yeah, she's getting drunk on stage. But I wasn't, though. I had water the whole time.
Yeah.
But
that's how it went down on public, on the social media.
Public, on the eye, in the eye of the public.
Yeah.
You know, on the social media, on the internet. She's an alkie. So, whatever.
Yeah. So what?
But that never happened again. I mean, I've bombed before, but I've never bombed like that again.
But you're able to deal with the, you don't go, do you not look at the social media anymore?
Look, I don't put a bunch of filters on my stuff, so yeah. I don't see everything people say.
Yeah.
But I see some things. And like people call me, it's so funny, you could tell who your real friends are, because your real friends, I'll be like, hey girl, you want to go out? You want to do something? I know you're probably feeling down. Like, you want to go out? I'm like, what's going on?
What
happened? What did I miss? And they're like, well, they saying this, whatever. But some people just call the gossip and be like, oh, they said this about, like, they don't even try to ask you if you want to go out, if you want anything. It's just like, they never call you unless something is a headline.
Right.
Like, oh, I heard you not with this person. Oh, I heard this. You good? Like, what happened? Yeah. Oh, was you at this party? When? Like, and it's just like, man, get the fuck off my line. Like, I end up like blocking them or like, don't answer their calls anymore.
Yeah.
But some days I just sit, like, mostly on my cycle. I will read the comments. And that's when I start. And on my cycle, I fire back.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, because I become evil.
Yeah.
And but I fire back with kindness.
Yeah.
You know, I try to curse them with joy. Because I can't. Because I'm evil at that point. You know.
You can't stop it.
I can't help myself. I'm like, these people don't fucking know me. And you got to remember, I'm from the 1900s.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 1900s, if somebody talks shit about you, you fucking cuss their ass out, or you talk shit about them. Like, you want to roast me? Let me roast you back.
But then they give them air, you know.
Yeah, but not no real air if it's from an anonymous page,
from a
bogus page.
Doesn't make
how
you
dare you talk about Tiffany Haddish like that, and you fat as fuck.
You do
you
that?
You fat, sloppy bitch. I Googled you. I researched you. You got your kids, all your light bill and everything's in your kids' name. You fucking abuser.
Yeah.
Using your kids.
That's what you do?
Sometimes. It makes me feel better. I don't do it that much anymore, but I used to. I used to respond all the time. And it was funny, I would respond and people would be a headline.
Yeah.
Tiffany claps back, like, are y'all sitting like this? Is real? I'm like, it took me a long time to realize how fucking famous I am.
Right.
Like, I didn't realize how.
When the next day is clickbait when you do anything.
Yeah, I'm just like, what? Like, this is crazy. Yeah, whatever. And I didn't realize it, like, till that second arrest. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm the shit.
Oh, for the...
Yeah, the DUI. Well, really, I was sleeping in the car, but...
Were you asleep in the car both times?
Yeah. Because I used to sleep in my car. It's where I'm comfortable sleeping. But apparently, that's illegal.
But would you pull over, or did you just wake up?
Yeah, I pulled over. I pulled over.
Yeah.
Like, in the Beverly Hills, when I parked perpendicular to the sidewalk as opposed to parallel, I should have parked parallel.
Oh, and you're just getting a little shut-eye?
Just a little shut-eye. I'm tired. I'm doing a lot. I mean, wake up
you're
at
busy.
5 in the morning,
yeah.
Work out for 2 hours,
yeah.
Then go home, you know, pull collard greens and onions and bell peppers and stuff from my garden.
Do you?
And, yeah, this is what I did on that day. It was Thanksgiving Day. I made a pot of greens, had that simmering. Then I go to the Laugh Factory, serve food to the homeless, over 2,000 people for hours on end.
Yeah.
Leave from there, go back to my house, get the collard greens. I had 2 turkeys, go over to my family's house, feed them, spend time with them for a few hours. Then I get a call from somebody saying, we don't have no food. They fired their chef. We need some food. Do you have any leftovers? I know you cooked. And I'm like, yeah, I do. I'll bring it to you. And then I brought the food, and I should have just like dropped it off and left. But, you know, I like to talk to my friends and chit chat. And I fall asleep on the couch and I wake up and weird shit's going on. I'm like, okay, I got to leave.
Oh, really?
And then I dropped people off. Like,
it's a big day.
It's crazy.
But did you?
But I realized at that moment, like, you know, after when I got home from jail or whatever, a few hours later, I got home, I realized how famous I actually am.
That's what did it. That's recently.
That's recently. That's when I realized, yo, I am. It was on like some Korean news. It was on Spanish news. It was like, all of, I'm like, oh, they can't say that I'm not international anymore.
Yeah. See, you could use that in your press package. Yeah,
I'm international.
I'm all over.
Matter of fact, if you Google famous black women, Google this. Google famous black women with DUIs. Arrested. Just famous black women arrested for DUIs.
Okay. Famous black women arrested DUI.
Who pops up?
You.
And who else?
It's a lot of you. I have to scroll down a bit. Oh yeah, it's a blank. Oh no, that's you. A black, someone mocking you. I don't know. Oh, Glorilla. Do you know her?
Yeah. She got arrested for a DUI?
Yeah, in Georgia. Yeah.
It probably wasn't even alcohol. It probably
Pooch
was
Hall.
Weed.
Pooch Hall. I don't know who
that's
is.
That's a man.
Yeah. Yeah, Glorilla is the only one that comes down.
Now, when
Danny Lee arrested for DUI in Miami, hit and run. Singer. I don't know who that is.
Yeah, that's somebody back.
And then
mama.
We get to Reese Witherspoon somehow.
Right, she's a black woman. When I had looked it up, I had gotten an argument with somebody, and I told him to Google it, and it was just me and Josephine Baker. So,
I didn't get Josephine.
Legendary.
Pretty good company.
But they was like, you ruined your whole career. I was like, did I ruin my whole career, or did I just find out how much people care about me?
Yeah.
How relevant I am.
Yeah.
Because I don't ever remember hearing about Glorilla. I don't remember hearing about no Derek Lee. Nobody, like, how much do they care? And there's other black actresses that are been famous longer than me and have had DUIs.
Yeah.
And they're you can't find them nowhere on there. Either they got some extra excellent people that know how to clean up the internet, or nobody cares.
Yeah. But did you feel like it impacted anything?
Not really. I mean, I started seeing who really cared about me on my team, who really cares about me as far as my friends go.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, you're famous now. You should never drive. You're famous. You're too famous to drive. I'm like, okay, well, you get famous to buy nice cars and stuff. And then who's supposed to drive? I'm supposed to let somebody else drive the car I want to drive? Yeah. Like, that don't make no sense. And I got a car that drives itself. Well, I had a car that drives itself. I had a Tesla.
What happened to that?
Somebody just T-boned me like last week.
Oh, shit.
T-bone hit my car. So I got to get a new car, and I think I'm going to get that. Right now I'm driving my hoopty from 2012.
I know. I was like, is that her?
Yeah, my little hoopty from 2012. I like driving that car, though, because like, I can go wherever I want. Nobody bothers me. Nobody's like, Tevin, hey, like, because they don't think it's me.
Do you park that at the apartment with the closet?
Yeah. Yeah, I drive that over there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, keep it hood, baby.
It's your old house. It's your old life. You can just check back in.
Yeah. And the old life sometimes blends into the new life. It helps.
So you found out who your friends are, and you found out who your people are, and like, you know.
Yeah, and who really cares, and like, and so I stopped drinking completely.
How's that going?
Easy.
Yeah.
I wasn't really a big drinker anyways.
Yeah.
So it was like, and I was only doing it in social settings.
Yeah.
And so I stopped drinking completely. I realized I was cleaning out my garage. I had like 4 years worth of alcohol. Like, people send you all these bottles of alcohol to give you all this stuff. So I had so much alcohol in my garage. I was like, oh, if I clear this out, I'll have like so much space. I could put a podcast studio in my garage. Clear out all
now
this alcohol.
The booze is gone.
Yeah. So I went ahead and instead of like throwing it away or whatever, I started doing these like at one of my other houses. I do now like a monthly game night.
Yeah.
I'm calling it a game night, but really it's like a Shabbat dinner.
Yeah.
And I invite like all my black friends and my Jewish friends, and I cook food and we play games.
Yeah.
Say a little prayer over the food. People bring some stuff. And I tell everybody, don't bring any alcohol, because there's plenty of alcohol here to drink. And now I'm down to probably like one more game night left worth of alcohol.
And there you go.
And then that's how
behind
you get rid of it.
You're not drinking at the game nights?
No, I'm not drinking at the game nights.
Is it hard?
No, it's easy. People always say that too. Isn't it hard to be around people that are drinking? Don't you feel like drinking
when
you're
around them? Well, they assume that you had a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, they do, I guess. And I'm like, no, it's not hard. It's actually more fun. I stopped smoking weed too. That's like, that was my thing. It really helped like my endometriosis and all that stuff. Do you know what endometriosis is?
Yeah, isn't it cysts in your ovaries?
Inflammation of the uterus.
Yeah, close. Yeah,
it can
cause
cysts. It can cause cysts on your ovaries, and it's like inflammation, extra lining grows outside and around, and it causes a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And great pain, great pain. And I think I was drinking to like mask that pain, to like feel that pain.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to sit through it for a little while, and then I found like different teas that I can take, and the doctor gave me some hormones to take, and that's been like kind of helping, but my chin hairs are getting a little crazy, and I'm losing hair on the side of my head, but whatever. You know, I'm pretty sure it's birth control, because birth control makes you ugly. So nobody wants to have sex with you. I'm like getting these crazy pimples and shit. And
you look good.
Well, I got rid of this. There was a big pimple here, and it was like my hair. I got on some makeup. Don't worry.
So the Jewish thing, you kind of locked in, huh?
Yeah, I locked in. I love it. You know, like, doing the, it's funny because my grandma used to always tell me, you know you're Jewish, your daddy Jewish, you know you're Jewish, your daddy Jewish.
Wild.
And I didn't believe her. Yeah. She was just saying that, trying to say I was different. I didn't even know what Jewish was really. She was just trying to say I was different.
Yeah.
And then I learned more about it, and I was doing the bar and bat mitzvahs and stuff, and like I would hear the prayers. It would make my soul feel good. I would hear them reading the Torah.
Oh,
it would like make my heart feel full.
Those melodies.
Yeah, like everything in the... all the prayers and the way to read the Torah, the Bible, it's like all musical, and it just felt right.
Yeah.
And then finally I meet my dad, and I had been studying all kinds of religions and different things, trying to figure out like what is good for me.
How locked in were Jehovah's Witnesses were you?
I mean, I used to go to the Theocratic Ministry School and go knock on the doors and stuff like that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then when I was married for a while, you know, I went to studying with the Jehovah's Witnesses and all of that. My husband was like, you know, you'd be a better wife if you was a Jehovah's Witness. But he didn't want to be a Jehovah's Witness, but he just knew.
How long ago was that?
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
That's anyways.
Yeah.
Anyways. But
you tried a lot of things.
I've tried a lot of things. I mean, yeah, I went to Scientology.
How
for
was that
11.
For you?
That was, I don't do bunk beds.
What do you mean? When did you do that? When did you try Scientology?
That was when I was homeless the second time.
Oh, so you're like, maybe I could live here, but you weren't going
to
do
it.
Well,
they wanted me
bed?
To live there. They wanted to open up some places in South Central and like in Inglewood.
They need a missionary.
Yeah. And
and
they wanted to have me on. They would pay me like $50 a month at the time. Like, but they would cover like food, clothing, room, board, all this stuff. And I was kind of down with that. And especially I'm homeless. And I had took a few courses there, and I kind of liked the people.
Yeah.
And then when they had took me to where I had to sleep, I was like, oh, no, I can't. The bunk beds, I can't do. I can't do this.
Yeah.
This is what I won't be doing.
The ideas, they made sense?
For the most part.
Yeah. But you didn't want to go all in.
I didn't want to go all in if I had to sleep in a bunk bed. I had signed a billion-year contract, too. They ended up tearing that up in my face because I was not having it. Baby. I was like, I'll sleep on the floor. They're like, you can't sleep on the floor. You know, because they kind of run it like a military kind of thing. So I wasn't having it.
Well, I think you dodged a bullet on that one.
Probably.
So the Jewish thing, you became, are you religious, you think?
Yeah, I'm pretty religious. I'll be at Passover tomorrow.
Yeah?
Yeah.
At your house? Where are you going?
To my rabbi's house. I hang out with my rabbi a lot. I go to Stephen S. White's temple. Yeah.
And you got bat mitzvahed?
Mm-hmm. I got bat mitzvahed. Sarah Silverman's sister.
I went to college with her, Susie.
With Susie? You went to college with Susie?
I did.
See?
Yeah.
Look at the small world.
Yeah.
She's so dope.
Yeah.
And her daughters are so dope.
They came over from Israel to do it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I flew them in.
Yeah.
Yep.
And how was
she? She helped me study. Her daughter helped me study.
You did a Haftorah and everything?
Mm-hmm. I did everything.
That's wild.
Yeah, I did it all. See, and that's to honor my father, you know, because before he passed, he was like, you know, no matter what you do, make sure you honor our ancestors, honor our people, make sure people know about Eritrea, make sure people, you know, you honor our ancestors and honor me.
Yeah.
So that was my way of doing that.
It's interesting, even after like him being out of your life for so long, that you were able to kind of get closure somehow.
Yeah.
You never had resentment or anger?
I did have resentment at first. At first, I was like so mad at him and hate him so much. Like, it just wanted to, I used to always say, when I meet him, I'll kick him in the dick.
Yeah.
But kick him in the nuts and be like, why'd you do this? Like, you gave birth to me, you know, you brought me here and then you didn't even look out for me. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, I was so mad about it. And this is like when I'm 16, 17, 18, 19. And then as I got older, I just realized, like, life is hard, you know? And I cannot be holding a grudge on somebody. I don't even really know him like that.
Yeah.
Even though I remember what he smelled like. Mm. I remember his voice. I remember his hair. Like, all these things. Like, and I was missing him.
Yeah.
Right? And I was, like, mad because I was missing him so bad.
Yeah.
And then when I finally met him, like, I wanted to be mean and mad at him. But, like, as soon as I looked in his eyes, it was like the three-year-old Tiffany was like, this is my daddy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and he was hugging me and holding me. I felt safe. Like, it's my dad, you know, like, it's my daddy.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be mad at him. I asked him a lot of questions, though, like, why? And as I'm talking to him and getting to know him, I'm just realizing, like, he had a lot of guilt. He didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
He had PTSD. He watched people be killed. Like, he came over here as a refugee. People were being slaughtered in this country. Like, he watched his friends die. All his brothers died. Like, he had a lot of issues.
Yeah.
You know, I can't be mad at him.
Yeah.
Like, although I wanted to be, and I don't know, like, it was some days I would get drunk and I would call him and, like, cry to him and be like, do you know how many men I slept with looking for a dad? Do you know what I did? Like, just confessing all these things that I did and, like, telling them. And he would, you could tell he was, like, feeling, like, bad about it, but all, at the same time, like, I guess happy that I was calling him.
Yeah.
And then, like, once I got all that off my chest, I kind of stopped doing that shit. But I wanted to fight him so bad.
You were putting it together. Younger. And were you doing a lot of therapy?
Yeah, a lot of therapy.
And that helped?
Some therapists helped. Some therapists was a waste of time. You know, I felt like at one point in time, I was going to therapy just to make the therapist laugh. Like, it wasn't even, I was performing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I was doing it to get the laugh, not to, like, really heal. It took a lot for me to get to a place where I'm like, okay, I want to heal.
And
I
putting
get
that
over
stuff together
shit.
About your old man, too, right?
Yeah, I wanted to get over it.
Yeah.
I wanted to learn, like, I'm still learning how to be, like, I think when I was married, I learned a lot about, like, how to live with a man and be with a man and, like, how to treat a man.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that wasn't the right man for me. He's a good man, but not good for me.
Yeah.
And, like, just trying to find that, like, I'm not even trying to find it no more. I was for a minute, but, like, I'm like, whatever.
Yeah.
Whoever God put in my lap, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure I'm cute and I'm nice.
Yeah.
Somebody show up. You know?
Yeah.
And I'm going to go out on dates. I definitely go out on dates and stuff. But I'm not, like, searching like I was.
And what do you get from your rabbi?
Good counseling, knowledge. I can ask him any kind of question, any question. He'll answer it. If he don't got the answer, he'll find the answer, bring me back something. Can argue with him a little bit. Like, so helpful. I think, I wish I had a rabbi sooner, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes I call Susie, I ask her all kind of crazy questions, too.
Really?
Like, I call Susan and ask her stuff, too. Like, it's refreshing to feel like, oh, I can ask these questions and not feel judged.
Yeah.
And not feel like a weirdo.
Yeah.
You know?
All kinds of questions.
All kinds of questions I'd be asking.
And not even related to, is it in relation to God?
Yeah, in relation to God. Like, you know, why do you think God put me in this situation, like in all this shit?
Right.
Like, why did I have to suffer so long? Why did I have to learn how to be a mom at such a young age? And I've lost so many babies now. Like, why would God do that to me? And then I'm wondering, was it God that did it to me or was it me that did it to
me? You've lost babies?
Oh, a lot of babies.
Yeah. That you wanted.
I don't know if I wanted them, but I was pregnant. So, I was out here. I was out here in no condoms.
Yeah,
I was taking chances.
And what do they usually say?
You have no real reason. But just listening to me. They would listen to me and then they would be like, well, why do you feel like that? And why do you think this? And why do you think? Like, they ask me questions. I answer them. And they like, answer some questions. And let's go to the tour and see. Let's go to this and see. Like, maybe there's an answer here. Like,
interesting.
You know?
Do you read the Torah?
I do.
Yeah?
I do. I think it's so pretty.
Yeah. Can you read the Hebrew?
Yeah, not very well, though.
Yeah.
I think I'll be making up stuff. And then I'm like, let me go to the English translation.
I thought you did a great job in the card counter.
Thank you.
That was an interesting part.
Oh, man. It was really cool to work with Paul Schrader.
I guess, right?
Oh, man. That's an interesting dude.
Yeah.
Like, deep in, like, a little creepy, but not creepy, but just, like, creepy because I didn't understand him at first. And then once I got to understanding him, I'm like, oh, this is so fucking cool. Like, he make cat people. You know, I love cat people. I love that movie. That's part of why I just say yes. Like, I was saying yes before I even read the script. I'm like, yes.
It's an interesting big part and kind of like, you know, different part, you know, right?
Yeah. I love to be able to show like other sides of me. I'm like an onion, man. There's many layers to the Haddish.
Yeah. And outside of the book, what are you working on now?
Now I'm working on this movie called The Deputy, and I'm working on music. I'm making music.
Oh, yeah?
And I got some stuff that's going to be coming out as far as movies go, little cameos and things.
How big is the part in the new Bad Boys movie?
It's small. It's cameo.
Oh. Was it fun being with Nicolas Cage in that movie?
Yes. That was great.
That's a funny movie.
That guy was he's so awesome.
Yeah.
I think he's super cool. Some of the other cast members like, he's turned off and she's this. I'm like, well, I bonded with him.
Yeah. He's Nicolas Cage.
He's Nicolas Cage, man.
Well, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you, too.
I'm glad we did it.
I'm glad we did this, too.
Okay, that was me and Haddish, and it was pretty great. It really turned out okay. Her book, I Curse You With Joy, comes out next week on Tuesday, May 7th. And hang out for a minute, folks. Hey, let me tell you something. This week, Full Marin subscribers got a new batch of unheard outtakes and moments that didn't make it into the WTF episodes proper. Like this part from my talk with Ben Mendelsohn.
Denzel
Unbridled.
It's joyous. Best. It's joyous. joyous. You want to know what else? Kurt Russell in Death Proof when he's in the car and getting smashed up. And it's the most joyous, overperformed, just having fun schlock moment. That's one of the great moments in cinema in the last 30 years for me is once he gets crashed up and smashed up and he's bashing around everywhere. Yeah. And you can just tell how much he's loving. They're just taking the piss. And it's fucking awesome.
To get bonus episodes twice a week, sign up for the Full Marin by going to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Guitar time.
Thank you. rumor lives, Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.